Matthew Arrett. Matthew, are you with us? Can you hear us?
I am indeed with you, yes, and I can hear you.
Perfect. Where are you? In Canada?
In Montreal, yes.
Montreal, okay. So shall we speak French or English?
We could do English. Let's do English.
I'm glad. We have a... Of course. I even speak Spanish, plus Japanese, plus Russian.
Wow.
Okay. Oh, yeah, of course.
I'm outclassed.
Just a few words. But we have a little clip that we want to play. It was done by our friend and colleague Tom Rentz, a U.S. Attorney who is heavily involved in these corona cases, one of the few attorneys who is willing to take on these corona cases. And he'll tell us about... how bad the situation really is, adverse reactions after so-called vaccinations. And then we'll, of course, immediately let you introduce yourself. But I just wanted to alert you that this is a really interesting thing that we're going to see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Regie, dann könnten wir mal dieses Video kurz einspielen.
We're back here with Dr. Brian Ayers. We did an interview with him, and he wasn't able to release the numbers at 3 o'clock. So 3 o'clock today, right here in Anaheim.
What happened, Brian?
As confirmed today by Thomas Rentz, I just filed federal papers in a lawsuit against the government, $45,000.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you what a woman who has incredible courage, who we're calling Jane Doe for right now, she gave me some information. She's an insider. She's a whistleblower. We're submitting to federal court today based on a sworn declaration. Under threat of perjury, this woman attested to this, and she is an expert. We know, based on what she said, that there have been at least 45,000 deaths from this vaccine. I'm going to tell you what I know. I know, based on this woman's testimony, because she has seen the inside of the systems, that there have been 45,000 deaths based on how many people died within 3 days of the vaccine in just one system that's reporting to the federal government. That there's been at least 45,000, and my guess, I've been working on this for a while now, is that it's immensely higher number, immensely. They know it. And they are covering it up, and I want investigations immediately. America's frontline doctors empowered me to file this suit in Alabama. Thank you, Simone. Thank you, Joey. Thank you, all of you that are doing this. Because of that suit, we were able to make these connections and define this. 45,000. You're going to get censored when you talk about this. And you know what? If they try and censor the risk, I would say that's complicity. And I cannot wait to find out in court. So let's see. 45,000. Let's see what they do. I want to challenge you all, okay? This is kind of a new idea for me, and it literally came to me this morning. It's a random thing. I have no idea if this will work. Since we can't talk about the 45,000 murders because people weren't able to give informed consent because they've been covering up the risk, let's try and get 45,000 to trend on Twitter. We can't call it murders, but maybe we can. Let's try and get it to trend on Facebook. Just post everywhere you can. Now, I want to suggest maybe you go to Clout Hub or something decent, because God knows Facebook and Twitter suck. Am I allowed to say that in the church? I'm sorry. I'm very fired up. I am, ladies and gentlemen. Eighty percent of the vaccinations have the 80% failure rate in Israel. They don't work. The absolute risk reduction from these vaccinations, 1%. You're being experimented on for 1%, and they want to experiment on my babies. I have an 8-year-old and 11-year-old. As God is my witness, hell will freeze over before I stand down on this.
Well, that's He could hardly hold his temper back, understandably so. And when he's saying that the true number is probably much, much higher, it's very obvious that it is. Because if that's what's reported to VAERS, and if in normal times only between 1 and 10% of the real cases are being reported, then we have vast underreporting, which... And we don't have normal times. We have times in which the mainstream media and the politicians who are in cahoots with the mainstream media are trying to do everything they can to keep people from reporting these cases. So if we start at 1%, then we're going to end up at 450,000 or 500,000 cases. And I think that's realistic, actually. And that's why many of us are now thinking this is nothing to do with health. This has to do with eugenics and genocide. And that's why I'm so glad that you accepted our invitation. Matthew, go ahead and tell us what you do and who you are.
Well, thank you for extending the invitation to me. And I am a Canadian-based journalist. I write for the Strategic Culture Foundation. I'm also the editor of a Canadian news magazine called the Canadian Patriot Review and the Rising Tide Foundation as well. Recently, I've written a series of books on the clash of the two Americas, some of the material I'm going to draw upon today. So thank you very much for asking me to deliver these remarks at this very important discussion. And what you're saying is very, very true. And it's something that a lot of people are afraid to look at. There's something certainly uncomfortable by the idea that some of the dominant ideas that got us into World War II many years ago are still not only influential, but dominant today, though they may have taken on different forms. And understanding and keeping that context, that historical sense of where we come from, what is the battle of ideas that shapes our present conditions, is so important if we're going to have any impact on being able to influence the future conditions that we want to bring into being. Obviously, the future is very underdetermined. And just like in 1929 and 1933, there is a clash over sets of ideas over how the world should be, right? And that's how I think that history is most usefully approached, is by looking not at history as things that happened in the past on the timeline, but rather a clash over competing ideas of the future. So history in that sense is about the future. Now, people would say that's not responsible historiography because that leads you into conspiracy theorizing, presuming, of course, the assumption there being that it is ideas and intentions and goals that shape our history. And we all know, smart people always know, that history and human society is just about random things just happening as they happen. You know, there's no intentions. There's no, you know, conspiracies. That's not scientific. So that this idea is something I wish to nip in the bud because I don't think it's very competent and it's not very useful. So I prepared a few slides and I'd like to just share those for the audience. Can you see my yeah. PowerPoint right now?
Yeah.
Okay, let me just make this full screen. Okay, it's a little bit slow. There we are. So I chose to label this short presentation. I think I have about 50 minutes to compress some big ideas, mm-hmm. Multiply connected ideas into a short presentation. So I chose to call this the Eugenics Roots of the Great Reset, or 100 Years to Flatten the Curve. That will make more and more sense. What we have there is an early rendition of the projections last year of the devastation caused by the new Black Plague coronavirus, according to the extrapolation, computer extrapolation of certain data sets that were linearly extrapolated into the future in March 23rd, 2020. And it was just Armageddon that was predicted to occur within just a few weeks, unless we flatten the curve. And we had 2 weeks to do that. Now that's already been well over a year, but as I make the point, it's the quality of thinking that I want to zero in on as I introduce some aspects of the pre-World War II years, World War II, and what came after. So the predicates change, but the quality of ideas don't. Now, a lot of people might have come to note that as of last year, there was a term that began to be used by folks around the Great Reset, namely the idea of folks around the World Economic Forum, about this idea of a Great Reset. Now, on the surface, this appeared to be a new idea in June 2020, where the concept that Klaus Schwab and many others of his ilk, the Davos crowd, were saying is that now it's a coronavirus. It might be bad, but it's actually given us a great opportunity. And this opportunity has been to finally do what we should have been doing for all of these past decades and combine two crises, deal with both coronavirus, the crisis of coronavirus, by creating new systems, new economic systems, new social control and medical systems around the world. Much of that noticeably had nothing to do with sovereign nation states having any role to play, except as appendages for new supranational institutions that would be brought online to manage the disorder. And the other thing was to combine that with a need to decarbonize in the Western civilization and, well, global civilization, to decarbonize with the idea that we could end the threat of global warming that would be causing, you know, ice caps to melt and cities to be flooded, and the world to be made uninhabitable by the year 2050, which was the so-called breaking point. So we had to do these two things, decarbonize and address coronavirus. And this Great Reset was supposed to combine both. And the more you began looking at what was the thinking behind the Great Reset, we could see that it wasn't so simple as even just those two things. You had concepts like that started emerging, like the Fourth Industrial Revolution. We had a lot of transhumanists like Ray Kurzweil, like he's the lead Google engineer, Ray Kurzweil, who's a transhumanist who started promoting very vocally on these World Economic Forum platforms, the idea of a singularity point. People like Yuval Harari was another darling of the World Economic Forum who they started trotting out at these Great Reset conferences and discussions, talking again about transhumanism and how even though there is no God and he is a devout atheist, he said, even though there has been no purpose in the universe or in biology or in anything, finally for the first time, and he's given so many conferences at these events, finally for the first time, intelligent design will make an appearance in about 2050. They all say this term 2050 is like the big year. And that intelligent design will not take the form of God or intelligent design in nature, but rather will be the CEOs of Google and of Facebook. And he's giving a lot of these speeches, always as a warning nominally, but really it's inevitable, he says, that human beings at the singularity point will merge with machines. Even Klaus Schwab has been on record saying that at this moment, you know, starting in 10 years from now, human brains will be microchipped so that we could interface with the Internet of Things. So there's this weird idea of a new phase of human evolution where human engineers, many of the people at the Davos crowd, will be those engineers managing the next phase of human evolution as we merge with machinery, as biotechnology also allows us to improve the human genetic stock. And I admit that there might be some positive applications for some things. If you're paralyzed or if you have a terrible hereditary illness, okay. Maybe there is a useful approach to some of this technology. However, I would say when you look at the actual current out of which this grouping of thought arises and what are the political agendas and ideologies surrounding the social control over today's especially Western unipolar world, it's not good. This will not be used for the good by and large, I don't believe. And so again, let's leap into a little bit of history. And a lot of this, which I'm about to go through, stemmed from a paper that I had recently read on 75 years later, is it not time to think about finally winning World War II? And in the paper, I try to make the case using many case studies of the fact that many of those perpetrators who brought fascism into being in the 1920s and 30s were never punished in Nuremberg. And by that, I have a picture there of Hjalmar Schacht, the head of the Reichsbank, and obviously the man with the funny mustache, And right next to him on the right side is Prescott Bush, the patriarch of two presidents. Nearly a third president had Jeb Bush not been knocked out in 2016. Prescott Bush, this is a good entry point to this discussion. He was a director of the Brown Brothers Harriman Bank that had formed when there was a merger in 1931 between a British bank, Montague Norman's family bank, actually, Brown Brothers, that merged with the Harriman Bank, run by Roland Harriman. So that was 1931. He was a director. He was also a leader of the Union Banking Corporation in America later on. And as a director of Harriman Bank, and by the way, Roland Harriman, who was the brother of Averill Harriman, is the one who tapped Prescott Bush to become a member of Skull and Bones earlier on in the 19-teens.
Is that now, an American bank? Harriman Bank?
It is. Yes, that's right. Brown Brothers Harriman.
Allow me 1 second to translate so that everybody can catch on, and to give you a break. Hang on, just a second. Also, Matthew Arrett ist ein Journalist, Autor und Geschichtsforscher. Er ist der Gründer und Autor von CanadianPatriot.org. Er hat gerade ein Buch geschrieben, Caught Between Two Worlds, The Untold History of Canada. Und er beschäftigt sich mit den mit der Eugenik während des Dritten Reichs. Nachdem der Krieg beendet war, haben die Institutionen und Wissenschaftler begonnen, dieses alte Ziel zu neuen Prinzipien für die Zukunft auszuheben. Und das Ganze hat dann Einfluss genommen auf den Great Reset. Matthew berichtet, dass einige der dominanteren Ideen des Dritten Reichs, zum Beispiel Eugenik, nicht etwa mit dem Dritten Reich untergegangen, sondern immer noch da sind. Er fing an mit einem kurzen Bericht, einem kurzen historischen Überblick, wonach eigentlich Geschichte immer sowas wie das Zusammenprallen mehrerer verschiedener Ideen sind, wenn man in die Geschichte zurückblickt, wie die Zukunft aussehen sollte. Und dann muss man gucken, was entwickelt sich daraus. Wurzeln des Eugenics. Manche glauben, das sei erst der Great Reset gewesen, der das gebracht hat, wo zum ersten Mal davon die Rede ist. Das stimmt natürlich nicht, sondern die Eugenik, die Idee der Eugenik hat im Dritten Reich schon Platz gefunden. Wir wissen inzwischen auch schon viel früher, aber im Dritten Reich war das dann eine ganz besonders bedeutungsvolle Richtung in der sogenannten Wissenschaft und auch in der Politik. Das ist keinem von uns entgangen. Er setzt an bei der Ingangsetzung dieser großen Pandemie, von der wir inzwischen wissen, dass es keine ist, sondern dass sie gefaked ist, dass aber leider ein großer Teil der Bevölkerung der Illusion zum Opfer gefallen ist. Das Ganze beruht auf einer reinen Computer-Extrapolation, also einem Computermodell. Und dieses Computermodell, unter anderem von Neil Ferguson, hat gesagt, oh mein Gott, wir werden Armageddon haben, wenn wir nicht jetzt sofort alles tun, um dieses Flattening the Curve zu erreichen. Allerdings ist das alles nicht neu, sondern das Ganze gab es schon im Zweiten Weltkrieg. Der Great Reset, wie er jetzt vom World Economic Forum gepusht wird, enthält ganz überwiegend Ideen von damals. Die Corona-Pandemie, so sagt es ja auch Klaus Schwab, auf den er hier gleich mehrfach Bezug genommen hat, die muss benutzt werden, damit wir jetzt endlich unsere Chance haben, ein komplett neues System in Gang zu setzen. In Wahrheit geht es dabei darum, dass Corona ein Ablenkungsmanöver ist, mit dessen Hilfe man erstens die ganzen übernationalen Strukturen, die frei erfundenen privaten Institutionen wie das World Economic Forum, wie das den World Monetary Fund und so weiter in Szene zu setzen, damit die dann sozusagen an Regierungsstelle treten. Und zweitens konzentriert man sich beim Great Reset auf das zweite Thema, das jetzt ja gerade haben wir es besprochen, Global Warming. Wir müssen also auch da jetzt aufpassen. Global Warming wird uns dazu bringen, dass die Welt, wenn alles so weitergeht, wie es bisher gelaufen ist, bis 2050 komplett unbewohnbar sein wird. Im Rahmen dieser beiden Ideen des Great Reset, also die supranationalen Strukturen, Institutionen inszenieren mit Hilfe von Corona, weil es kann ja niemand auf der nationalen und gar auf der regionalen Ebene sich mit so einer schlimmen Krise wie Corona überhaupt nur zurechtfinden. Also braucht man diese supranationalen Strukturen. Zweitens Global Warning. Da wird auch verpackt die vierte industrielle Revolution. Da hat Matthew eben Bezug genommen, unter anderem auf so merkwürdige Menschen wie Ray Kurzweil. Das ist jemand, der bei Google arbeitet und ein ganz starker Anhänger von Transhumanismus ist, also dem Verschmelzen des Menschen mit der Maschine. Ein weiterer Mensch, von dem haben wir neulich was gehört, Harari, ganz dunkle Gestalt, strenger Atheist, was für sich genommen kein Problem ist. Aber er sagt, es gibt im gesamten Universum, und jetzt muss man sich fragen, glaubt er wirklich an sowas? Es gibt im gesamten Universum keinen Zweck, kein Ziel, nichts gibt es. Aber wir, also solche Kasper wie er, wir können es jetzt machen, wir sind jetzt in der Lage und werden bis 2050 den Menschen mit der Maschine verknüpfen und dann haben wir endlich einen Purpose, ein Ziel. Wir sind jetzt dabei, in eine neue Phase der menschlichen Evolution überzugehen. Das Ganze managen wir. Also diese Davos-Crowd, wie Matthew das nennt, da sind auch sicherlich, sagt Matthew, ein paar gute Ideen dabei, aber unterm Strich ist das alles völliger Wahnsinn und ganz, ganz schlimm. Und jetzt ist er gerade dabei, in den historischen Hintergrund einzutauchen, hat uns gerade ein Bild gezeigt, auf dem drei Figuren zu sehen waren, nämlich Hitler, Hjalmar Schacht und Prescott Bush. Das ist der Vater von dem älteren Präsidenten Bush. Dieser Prescott Bush hat eine Bank mitgegründet, die durch eine Verschmelzung zustande gekommen ist in 1931. Okay, I got as far as Prescott Bush then.
Okay, let me ask you this. I didn't realize that we'd be translating this presentation into German as well, and I compressed a lot of information in the next 40 minutes. I'm going to have to, I think, cut out a lot in my mind if we're going to get through it while doing German and English. Will we be continuing this?
Oh, I think that's okay because this is so important. And also, if you do want to compress it, do you have a written outline that maybe we can...
No. No, but I can make a written outline available to you later on.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. Cool. Let's just play it by ear. It'll work.
Okay. All right. So I'll compress and stop me whenever you need to translate for your audience.
We should have a translator, but he's sick today.
Oh, that's okay. All right.
So we'll do that.
Mm-hmm. I'll do some mental chopping. All right. So in short, Brown Brothers Harriman and Prescott Bush specifically provided vital loans to Hitler when he lost the elections in 1932 to Kurt von Schleicher, the anti-fascist leader who was trying to bring back... I mean, Schleicher was and you don't have to translate this necessarily, but Schleicher was an assistant with Walter Rathenau in the 1922 to 23 Rapallo Accords that would have put a stop to Weimar hyperinflation had it been permitted to go through and had the organization Consul not been deployed to kill Rathenau. So keep in mind, Kurt von Schleicher was, when he became Chancellor, was a member of that delegation, was a follower of Friedrich List, was an anti-fascist who was going to bring in a Lautenbach plan for the economic reconstruction of Germany without the Bank of International Settlements and without a variety of these Western financiers who, like Prescott Bush, provided, again, vital loans to Hitler when Hitler was contemplating suicide. At that critical moment, and that vital loan kept the Nazi party going until a soft coup could be arranged and Hitler was made chancellor, and we know the dark days that followed from that. Later on, Prescott Bush had all of his assets confiscated with Union Banking in 1942 for trading with the enemy because people inside the United States working with Roosevelt found it very conspicuous that his bank, as well as the DuPont, the Rockefeller machine, Standard Oil, were all working very heavily to support the supplies and also financing for fascism's rise throughout the 1930s into World War II. This is after World War II began. So I'm going to cut out everything I was going to say about that, but all that to say, books have been written. This is eminently investigatable. These were the folks that were not punished at Nuremberg. And that includes also German aristocracy. There was a big fight over in Britain, in the British aristocracy, over what would be Britain's role. Would it continue to support Hitler as the financier oligarchs had been doing under the Bank of International Settlements, the Bank of England, throughout the 1920s and up until 36. There was a consensus that Hitler was the way to go. Over there, we have King Edward VIII, the guy who taught young Elizabeth to do the Nazi salute, and his wife, Jessica something or other, Wallace Simpson, meeting with Hitler. He was ultimately ousted, but there were plans all the way through World War II while he was sitting in Franco's Spain to arrange for his reinstallation in as the king of a Nazi-friendly England. Neville Chamberlain, who was also a pro-Nazi sympathizer, a prime minister, was ousted in 1940 when the decision was made to stop, that the Frankenstein monster could no longer be controlled as many had believed it could be earlier on as an enforcer of a new world order. And so Neville Chamberlain was ousted, a more, a different type of personality was brought in with Winston, and the game was changed. So one thing I just want to add to this, too, is that there was a Great Reset Conference in 1932. So at the height of the Depression, which was, again, an instigated thing, the Depression was caused by a coordinated banker's call loan called in 1929 that resulted in the predictable spreading of defaults that had been holding up the roaring 20s bubble economy, and that controlled when on the same day everybody had called in their broker call loans, it got everyone to realize that the money didn't exist. It was a fake bubble economy. That was a pinprick that strategically blew up the economy. People like JP Morgan and others had been able to purchase up pennies on the dollar, companies in the physical economy, farms and other things throughout the 1920s and the Great Depression, when they sold their shares early before the blowout that they knew was going to happen. And in 1932, there was a international London conference. That's what I call the Great Reset Conference of 32, sponsored by the League of Nations and the Bank of International Settlements to create basically a banker's dictatorship to resolve the problems of the Great Depression internationally. This was presided over by the King of England. 65 nations were involved, but they needed the United States. Unfortunately, the United States didn't, not unfortunately, fortunately for us, the United States chose to pull out and sabotage the entire proceedings after 6 months. And the London conference, the Great Reset Conference, was sabotaged. It didn't happen. That might be a good place to maybe recap for your German audience before I shift gears.
Thanks. I think so. Also, dieser Prescott Bush war jemand, der im großen Stil Hitler Darlehen gegeben hat. Hitler, der bis dahin versucht hat, den neuen Kanzler Kurt von Schleicher aus dem Rennen zu kippen. Dieser Kurt von Schleicher war ein Antifaschist, der in der Lage gewesen wäre, Assistent von Walter Rathenau, der in der Lage gewesen wäre, Deutschland nach dem Krieg, nach dem Ersten Weltkrieg wieder aufzubauen, ohne die Finanzierung von zum Beispiel der Bank of International Settlement, wie heißen die hier, Bank für internationale
Zusammenarbeit
irgendwie,
oder?
Nee, irgendwie anders, aber so ähnlich. Und der wurde unterlaufen. Hitler, der zu dem Zeitpunkt offenbar so am Boden zerstört war, dass er, so sagt es eben, Matthew an Suizid dachte, bekam nun plötzlich Geld von der Bank von Prescott Bush, aber auch von großen Unternehmen, wie zum Beispiel der Familie, und das ist ja auch ein Unternehmen, DuPont, aber auch vielen anderen, die den Faschismus offenbar finanzieren wollten. Es gab um diese Zeit auch einen großen Streit in England. Was machen wir nun mit diesem Hitler? Kann man den noch unter Kontrolle halten? Es war aber wohl so, dass eine Reihe von wichtigen Persönlichkeiten, unter anderem das englische Königshaus, damals der König Edward, das ist der die amerikanische Geschiedene, das war damals ein Skandal, Frau, jetzt habe ich den Namen vergessen, Wallace Simpson war das, genau, geheiratet hat. Der fand das alles ganz genial, dass Hitler aufstieg und diesen Größenwahnsinn gepusht hat. Oder vielleicht hat er es auch selber mitgepusht und benutzt oder glaubt benutzen zu können, dieser King Edward. Das ist derjenige, sagt Matthew eben, der auch Königin Elisabeth den Hitlergruß beigebracht hat. Es gab aber um diese Zeit auch noch einen Außenminister, Neville Chamberlain, der so ein bisschen bekannt geworden ist durch seine Appeasement-Politik. Man weiß nicht, was das genau bedeutet. Also er hat immer gute Miene zum bösen Spiel gemacht, wahrscheinlich, weil er geglaubt hat, man könnte Hitler, indem man halbwegs nett zu ihm ist, unter Kontrolle halten. Ging aber nicht wirklich. Und das Erstaunliche ist, dass es damals schon, sagt Matthew, eine Bemühung um einen Great Reset gegeben hat. In 1932, also kurz bevor 1936 dann alles Richtung Faschismus taumelte. In 1932 wurde ein Versuch unternommen, in England unter der Schirmherrschaft des Königs von England und ich weiß nicht mehr, wie viele Staaten dabei gewesen sind, sowas wie eine Great Reset-Konferenz in Gang zu setzen. Kurz vorher hat es die große Depression gegeben, Great Depression, auch das war inszeniert. Die Banken haben hier alle auf einen Schlag irgendwelche Darlehen wieder eingezogen, sodass, es passiert jetzt auch gerade, sodass eine Menge Leute plötzlich nackt da standen. Da konnte dann die Banker und ihre Hintermänner für einen Apfel und ein Ei die zerstörten Unternehmen und auch natürlich Immobilien kaufen. Diese Bubble, die sich bis dahin gebildet hatte. Es gab diesen Begriff der Roaring Twenties. Erinnert sich einer, wir nicht persönlich, aber der eine oder andere erinnert sich aus Filmen daran. Da ist volle Pulle gefeiert worden. Das Geld ist nur so zum Fenster rausgeworfen worden. Und plötzlich stellte sich raus, oh mein Gott, das ganze Geld ist nur gedruckt. Die Economy war kaputt, weil in dem Moment die Banker den Stecker gezogen haben. All das, was man uns jetzt auch wieder ankündigt. Und dann haben diese Banker, diese selben Banker, geglaubt, sie könnten diesen Great Reset zurechtbasteln und selbst diktieren, wie die Welt fortan zu leben hat. In 1932 war das unter der Schirmherrschaft des Königs von England, ist aber schiefgegangen, weil sie die Amerikaner brauchten und die haben glücklicherweise, sagt Matthew, nicht mitgemacht. Die haben den Stecker gezogen. Okay, I got that much.
Yeah, your power of memory is quite impressive. I'm surprised that you can condense that or summarize that.
I'm taking notes.
Oh, I can see that. Yeah, that's good. Okay. All right. So this gets us at. Oh, and by the way, Kurt von Schleicher assassinated in 1934, netted the long knives with many, many others. And this is after the Reichstag fire and other false flags were deployed to get the ball rolling on temporary enabling acts that would help the Führer restore order, as we all know. And we've seen a reproduction of this type of technique of social control through fear and false flags many times over the ensuing 70 years, including, I would say, the events of Event 201 probably should ring some alarm bells there. So just a quick side note there. You don't have to summarize that. Mm-hmm. but this now helps us shift gears into the second thing I want to get at, because Hitler is often, as bad of a phenomenon, he's often caricaturized as a unidimensional supervillain from a comic book. And the ideology of eugenics is often overshadowed or obscured into what was this and how were these Western Wall Street, City of London, upper establishment forces completely supporting, not only supporting, of leading driving forces of eugenics. In 1932, just as the Great Reset Conference was getting into play, there was the New York Third Eugenics Conference being hosted. This is right before Roosevelt was elected. And this eugenics conference had the sponsorship of the Harriman family. J.P. Morgan's leading financiers, William Draper Jr., was a leading sponsor. The Rockefeller Foundation, the Macy Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation were major pro-eugenics forces. So it wasn't just the industrial arm of IBM and other things that people know, or the banking system alone that was supporting fascism, including Mussolini. You know, Mussolini was Time's Man of the Year 8 times. Until World War, between 1923 and 45, 8 times. Henry Luce, huge fascist. And this was being sold at this time, this is the Great Depression, as the economic miracle solution for the world. Americans who are being broken emotionally under not being able to feed their families were being told, I mean, that you just had to give up your liberties and you'll get security again. So this eugenics conference was becoming very popular, and a lot of money was being put into eugenics research. The Kaiser Wilhelm Institute had received millions of dollars in Germany with Ernst Rudin from the Rockefeller Foundation and Macy Foundation. So At the opening keynote address, Fairfield Osborne, a leading eugenicist, a student of Thomas Huxley, actually, in London, who plays maybe in a future presentation, I can go through Thomas Huxley's nefarious role in the 19th century. But all that to say, he gives this address where he makes the point that, it's just something is covering this, where he says eugenics aids and encourages the survival and the multiplication of the fittest. Indirectly, it would check and discourage the multiplication of the unfitted. As to the latter, in the United States alone, it is widely recognized that there are millions of people who are acting as dragnets or sheet anchors to the progress of the ship of state. While some highly competent people are unemployed, the mass of unemployment is among the less competent, who are first selected for suspension, while the few highly competent people are retained because they are still indispensable. In nature, these less fitted individuals would gradually disappear, but in civilization, we are keeping them in the community in the hopes that in brighter days they may all find employment. This is only another instance of humane civilization going directly against the order of nature and encouraging the survival of the unfittest. So this, I think, encapsulates the general paradigm of eugenics by the extension of the Darwinian model of evolution onto the controlled weeding out of the weeds of the human gene pool, the human garden. The idea of the science of it was always premised around the statistical extrapolation of, oh, your parent, your dad had a low IQ, your grandpa had a low IQ, your father had, or your mother was a criminal, your grandmother was a criminal. Well, we're going to use statistical probability to extrapolate into your children, grandchildren, and unborn great-grandchildren the likelihood that they will also have low IQs or being prone to criminality. And on that basis, we will be able to say and justify whether or not you will be sterilized. In the United States alone, over 70,000 people were sterilized up until World War II. This continued on until the 70s. In Germany, we know that the effects of this resulted in about 400,000 Germans being sterilized. So 30 states of the U.S. had passed eugenics laws by 1933, two provinces in Canada, Alberta and British Columbia. And Hitler, when he applied his first eugenics laws in June 1933, that was modeled openly on the success of the American model of eugenics laws. He was just a little bit more honest and vigorous about it, but it was all modeled on what was already being done in the West. I don't know if that's a place you want to recap.
Yeah, that's perfect. Okay. Also, Kurt von Schleicher, der so ein bisschen hätte im Weg stehen können von Hitler, wurde ermordet. Und jetzt geht Matthew auf Hitler ein. Hitler wird sehr häufig karikiert. Er eignet sich ja auch bestens als Karikatur. Charlie Chaplin hat es ja auch getan. Aber Matthew sagt, so richtig eine richtige Karikatur war er ja gar nicht. Denn man darf nicht vergessen, dass zu dieser Zeit, zu Beginn der 30er Jahre, eine gigantische Gruppe von sehr reichen und einflussreichen Industriellen in der westlichen Welt versucht hat, mit ihm zusammenzuarbeiten, ihn unterstützt hat. Wir haben eben schon von den Darlehen gehört, die er bekommen hat. 1932 gab es, das darf man nicht vergessen, weil wir gleich auf 1933 kommen, gab es in New York die dritte Eugenics Conference. Da waren alles, was Rang und Namen hat, war dabei. Da war die Rockefeller Foundation, die Rockefeller Familie, Morgan Stanley, die Carnegie Foundation, die Macy Foundation. Alle waren da. Zu dieser Zeit war auch Mussolini schon mehrfach zum Mann des Jahres gewählt worden. Die Amerikaner waren um diese Zeit nach der Great Depression völlig K.O., aber dachten, naja, jetzt wird es ja langsam wieder besser. Und da spielte plötzlich diese Eugenics-Idee eine große Rolle. Übrigens, auch zu diesem Zeitpunkt hat die Kaiser-Wilhelm-Gesellschaft, das ist der Vorläufer des, Max-Planck-Instituts, Kaiser-Wilhelm-Gesellschaft, Vorläufer des Max-Planck-Instituts, haben die auch schon Millionen Dollar Millionen Dollar für die Forschung an Eugenics bekommen. Und jetzt hat er eben einen anderen Menschen, der nennt sich Fairfield Osborne, zitiert. Da haben wir gerade noch das Ganze im Bild. Der letzten Endes genau das, was dann kurze Zeit später von Hitler kam, vorweggenommen hat, indem er gesagt hat, hier, das sind lauter nutzlose Esser, wir halten diese ganzen kaputten Leute am Leben, und hat sich immer mehr in Richtung Darwins Survival of the Fittest engagiert. Hat auch gesagt, wir können uns das gar nicht leisten, darauf zu hoffen, dass die Kaputten irgendwie vielleicht doch noch überleben werden. Und ist dann im Rahmen der Eugenics ist man dann auf die Idee gekommen, eine statistische Herangehensweise für den einzelnen Menschen zu bilden. Man guckt also nach, dein Vater hatte einen niedrigen IQ. Ist die Wahrscheinlichkeit groß, dass du auch einen haben wirst. Dein Vater war kriminell, also ist die Wahrscheinlichkeit groß, dass du auch kriminell wirst. Es wurden allein in den USA bis zum Beginn des Zweiten Weltkriegs 70.000 Menschen mit solchen Argumenten sterilisiert. In 30 Staaten wurde bis 1933 Eugenics Laws eingeführt, bis dann Hitler im Juni 1933 seine eigenen Eugeniker-Ideen der Welt präsentiert hat, von der bis vor kurzem die ganzen Menschen dachten, das sind seine Ideen, waren sie aber nicht, sondern er hat das ganz offen modelliert und sich ausgerichtet an dem amerikanischen Modell. Okay.
Okay. Let me just do the next. So I have 20 minutes here to wrap things up. So I'm going to try to get through this. All right. So there's some famous pollsters supporting eugenics. This is how much a person who is, handicapped costs to maintain for the state. Wouldn't that money be best spent on other more useful things? This is an image. I mean, a lot of people need to really get this as well, that eugenics was a recapitulation of a lot of the same assumptions, axiomatics that were contained within the thought of Thomas Malthus. This is a projection curve of the Malthusian population crisis that could be forecast because food grows arithmetically in nature and human beings grow geometrically as we reproduce, said Malthus. British East India Company official economist for the British Haileybury School. And so he said the purpose of government is to flatten the population curve in any way possible using the gifts God nature gave us, including famine, disease, war, to encourage population control. This was a dismal thing that was being rejected throughout the 19th century as people began realizing that human beings were creatures endowed with creative reason and were able to make constant discoveries when they were encouraged and given opportunities. And this is what we saw coming out of a lot of the industrial booms around the world. So they didn't really believe in Malthus because people were constantly overcoming these Malthusian population crisis points by being creative. That was the key out of this because computer models, even before the days of computers, people thought like computers. They cannot predict creative thought occurring. It's nonlinear. So that's something that they don't want to accept. I would add here one thing that Franklin Roosevelt didn't accept fascism or eugenics, thank God. I mentioned that he sabotaged the London Bankers Conference. he also deployed a war against Wall Street to break up the banks. Hundreds of bankers went to jail. He suffered an assassination attempt that he survived, a military coup d'etat in 1934 at Smedley Butler. That was subverted, thankfully. And he began to break up the banks, force credit to go towards long-term projects for the future in order to give people who were perhaps otherwise prone to stealing or whatever opportunities to develop skills, have a job, and have hope for the future, which is a much better way of curing human society of its negative effects is to give people an opportunity that's real for the future instead of allowing economic injustice or to run rampant for fascists trying to manipulate us. So I'm going to skip some stuff in my mind here, but...
was that the New Deal?
That was the New Deal, which was a major fight, yeah, between the two different aspects, the deep state America and the actual genuine constitutional American traditions of Lincoln went to war at the New Deal. But the New Deal overall was animated by a rejection of private finance over sovereign nation states. And FDR had arranged in the post-war age, before FDR died early and under very mysterious circumstances, he had arranged a win-win system of empowering sovereign nation states based on a U.S.-Russia-China alliance in the post-war epoch. Unfortunately, his death and the labeling of all of his allies, like Henry Wallace, Harry Dexter White, as red commie traitors under McCarthyism, resulted in the killing of that outlook for the future. And instead, we had the Iron Curtain speech and the reestablishment of eugenics. Julian Huxley, the grandson of Thomas Huxley, who was himself a major, I mean, the whole family played a very nefarious role as upper-level thought managers for the empire. He wrote in the founding document of UNESCO, the United Nations Education, Science, and Cultural Organization, which people can read fully online. He said, at the moment, it is probable that the indirect effect of civilization is dysgenic instead of eugenic. And in any case, it seems likely that the dead weight of genetic stupidity, physical weakness, mental instability, and disease proneness, which already exist in the human species, will prove too great a burden for real progress to be achieved. Thus, even though it is quite true that any radical eugenic policy will be for many years politically and psychologically impossible, it will be important for UNESCO to see that the eugenic problem is examined with the greatest care and that the public mind is informed of the issues at stake so that much that is now unthinkable may at least become thinkable. Obviously, by this time, the world had come to see the ugly effects of eugenics in Nazi Germany, and people were no longer enchanted by the idea of social engineers and bodies of experts approving who lives and who dies for the benefit of the purity of the global race. So how did Julian Huxley, who, by the way, was at this time a leading member, and he became the president of the British Eugenic Society, name changed in 1988, by the way, to the Galton Institute, tied very heavily to a lot of the Gavi crowd today, and AstraZeneca also. So there's a whole body of research.
What's the name of that institute when they changed it?
That is the British Eugenic Society, changed names to the Galton Institute. But he was the president of the Eugenic Society. He is the founder of the term transhumanism. This is Julian Huxley. He is also the father of modern environmentalism. In 1948, he created the International Union for the Conservation of Nature alongside Max Nicholson, another leading eugenics proponent. They together, along with Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands and Prince Philip Mombatin, in 1961, created the World Wildlife Fund of Nature for the explicit purpose of providing funds for the International Union of Conservation of Nature. And he was the author in 1961 of the Morgues Manifesto, which even on the World Wildlife Fund website admits that this is the sort of founding document for modern conservationism and environmentalism as a way to sort of change the former ethic, the former wisdom that human beings should be defended from empires, to the idea instead, no, that's wrong. That's the old wisdom. The new wisdom is that nature needs to be defended from human beings. And that became the new governing ethic that was brought into being over the dead bodies of many, many people who were trying in the 1960s to revive the spirit of Franklin Roosevelt, including John F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Enrico Mattei, Charles de Gaulle, who had tried to, you know, resist this unipolar doctrine, this NATO doctrine inside of France, and to create a different type of win-win architecture, even involving here where I live in Quebec. This was all subverted. This positive drive to reawaken this spirit of optimism was subverted, and a lot of the political institutions established by these folks. And I'll just read one last thing before you can summarize, and that might be it for the presentation. Julian Huxley, in that same document, writes, "The moral for UNESCO is clear. The task laid upon it of promoting peace and security can never be wholly realized through the means assigned to it, education, science, and culture. It must envision some form of world political unity, whether through a single world government or otherwise, as the only certain means of avoiding war. In its educational program, it can stress the ultimate need for a world political unity and familiarize all peoples with the implications of the transfer of full sovereignty from separate nations to a world organization." So maybe I gave you a lot there to summarize. I'll maybe have a few remarks at the end where I can wrap it all together.
This is great. I mean, it's we're seeing this right now. Incredible. Also, Es gab einen, also das, was Matthew zuletzt beschrieben hat, ist, dass es ja, im Dritten Reich gab es Bilder, wir haben eben einige davon gesehen, da wurden Behinderte gezeigt, das war eben ein Bild mit einem Arzt offenbar im Hintergrund, der scheinbar beschützend seine Hand auf die Schultern legt, aber darunter steht, die 60.000 Reichsmark, schätze ich mal, waren das gewesen, die man für diesen Menschen verwendet, das kann man doch viel besser auch für ganz andere Zwecke verwenden. Der Herr Malthus von der British East India Company sagte, dass der Zweck des, der Regierung derjenige ist, die den Bevölkerungszuwachs zu erschweren, zu verhindern. Flatten the population, klingt so ähnlich wie flatten the curve. Aber dann kamen irgendwann Leute auf die Idee zu erkennen, Mensch, der Mensch ist ja kreativ, der kann ja was, der bewegt ja was. Da konnte man dann mit dieser Idee die Menschen einfach so nach der eben schon beschriebenen statistischen Methode ja, zu töten, konnte man diese Idee nicht mehr richtig so, nicht mehr so richtig gut verfolgen. Damals schon war es so, dass obwohl es noch gar keine richtigen Computer gab, die Computermodelle oder die Menschen dachten oder die Leute, die diese Eugenics gepusht haben, dachten wie Computer, also wie ja, digitale Strukturen, nicht wie Menschen. Aber sie sind eben nicht in der Lage, das Kreative zu sehen. Das ist auch heute höchstwahrscheinlich unser ganz großer Vorteil. Die können einfach, die haben keinen Zugang zu Kreativen, zum Instinkt, zum Spirituellen. Und Franklin Roosevelt wollte nun definitiv in dieser Aktion nicht mitmachen. Ich meine, er hat sich ja noch an das erinnert, was bei Hitler los gewesen ist. Hitler ist ja der Alleinschuldige geworden im geschichtlichen Rückblick. Wie wir jetzt gerade erfahren haben, war es gar nicht Hitler alleine, sondern er hat einfach nur was übernommen. Roosevelt wollte dabei jedenfalls nicht mitmachen und hat sich dagegen gestemmt, sodass das nicht mehr weiterging. Es gab dann sogar einen Attentatsversuch auf ihn. Er hat den Menschen mit dem, was man heute als New Deal bezeichnet, eine Chance gegeben. Hat gesagt, hier jeder kriegt eine Ausbildung, jeder kriegt so viel, wie er braucht, damit er sich entwickeln kann. Und es gab einen gigantischen Fight zwischen ihm und seinen Leuten und auf der anderen Seite dem, inzwischen weiß ja jeder, was das ist, dem Deep State über diesen New Deal. Er hat auch dafür gesorgt, dass diese privaten Finanzierer, die immer wieder versucht haben, die Kontrolle zu bekommen, draußen vorblieben. Er hat sogar nach dem Krieg ein Win-Win-System aufgebaut, Franklin Roosevelt, ein Win-Win-System aufgebaut, als Epoche, als Post-War-Epoche. Und da wären die USA und Russland eine Allianz eingegangen. Also das wurde dann sozusagen gecancelt von seinen Gegnern, also von denjenigen, mit denen wir es heute auch zu tun haben, dieselben Gegner von damals, das werden wir noch mal von Vera Sharaf hören, sind dieselben Gegner, die wir heute vor uns sehen, dieselben Monster. Und stattdessen kam es zu dem berüchtigten, von dem wir ja einige auch noch Erinnerungen haben, Eisernen Vorhang, anstatt diese von Roosevelt angedachte Allianz. Jetzt bewegen wir uns ins Jahr 46. Da kam dann Julian Huxley, der Enkel, glaube ich, von Aldous Huxley.
Nee, das ist der, er hat gesagt, glaube ich, Tom Huxley.
Ja, genau, genau.
Das ist der
genau.
Bruder. Ja, Aldous Huxley ist der Bruder von
genau,
ihm.
Genau. Also der andere hat, der Bruder von Julian Huxley, Aldous Huxley, hat dieses Buch Schöne neue Welt geschrieben, Brave New World. Und dieser Typ hier, die ganze Familie scheint verseucht zu sein, dieser Typ hier, Julian Huxley, hat in 1946 bei der Gründung der UNESCO wieder die Eugenics gebracht. 46, ein Jahr nach Kriegsende. Wir brauchen die Eugenics, sagt er. Alles andere ist Dysgenics. Wir können keine Menschen, die körperlich oder psychisch instabil sind, gebrauchen. Die müssen weg. Konnte das dann aber doch nicht pushen, weil sich doch zu viele Menschen daran erinnert hatten, dass da gerade mal ein Jahr vorher KZs aufgemacht worden waren und Menschen gerettet worden waren vor genau diesen Gedanken. Hat aber damals, in 46, hat er in seiner Rede gesagt, na, im Moment können wir noch nicht so offen darüber reden, über die Reinheit der globalen Rasse und so weiter, aber wir müssen diese Gedanken der Eugenics weiter pushen, denn es wird der Zeitpunkt kommen, da können wir da wieder offen drüber reden. Ja, vielleicht ist das heute der richtige Zeitpunkt. Er ist Präsident der British Eugenics Society geworden, deren Name sich irgendwann geändert hat. Er ist der Erfinder des Wortes Transhumanismus und er hat außerdem, und das müssen wir uns genau vor Augen führen, sodass wir erkennen können, dass vieles von dem, was er als NGO unterwegs ist, von den gleichen Typen kommt, die Eugenics wollen. Er hat den modernen Umweltschutzgedanken entwickelt, der aber darin kulminierte, dass er sagte, die Natur muss vor dem Menschen geschützt werden. Früher war es genau andersrum, man könnte ja auch an Kompromiss denken. Und zusammen mit Prinz Bernhard von den Niederlanden und Prinz Philip Mountbatten, also der berühmte Battenberg, der, so hieß er ja in Wahrheit vorher, also der gerade verstorbene Prinz Philip, hat zusammen mit Prinz Bernhard den World Wildlife Fund gegründet. Weiß auch keiner. 1961. Und da wurde dann die neue Weisheit ausgerufen, dass die Natur gegen den Menschen geschützt werden muss. Andere, wie zum Beispiel Bobby Kennedy, haben sich schwer dagegen gewehrt. Aber die Moral für die UNESCO war, wir brauchen, das ist wichtig, 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 wir brauchen ein weltpolitisches System, weltpolitische Einheit, wir brauchen eine World Government, um Krieg zu verhindern. Dazu muss jede Regierung, dazu muss jedes Volk seine Souveränität aufgeben. Das kommt uns sehr bekannt vor. Wir müssen nur, meiner Ansicht nach, dafür sorgen, dass es keinen Krieg gibt. Dann brauchen wir auch kein World Government. Den Krieg, den die andere Seite jetzt versucht zu inszenieren unter uns, den müssen wir in die richtige Richtung lenken, gegen die wirklich Verantwortlichen. I was just saying, summing up, that what we need to do is avoid war. We need to know who is our real enemy. The real enemy, obviously, from what you're telling us, is the global corporations and the global NGOs who are behind all of this.
Well, I mean, people just need to think a little bit more about the nature of oligarchy. It's such a obscured, again, cartoonified term idea. But when you really look at what are what is the causal thrust, the causal nexus of history, where are the core ideas that shaped events for good and for bad? Because conspiracies, I don't believe, are just evil. You could have good conspiracies too, as we saw with the case of Franklin Roosevelt's intention to create a post-war age of sovereign nation states cooperating under big projects. Mm-hmm. But people need to get a sense of both of those two things. And I think when you continue on, and it's painful how much I had to cut out of this presentation to give, and maybe in a future presentation I could elaborate on this. But again, the idea of flattening the curve manifested in the application of information theory to projecting the warming trends based on selective data sets that have no bearing in reality into the future to shut down industrial civilization and stop CO2, to stop, you know, to flatten the curve, to stop this crazy warming that was evident in CO2 causing temperature change. And a lot of this manifested and turned into depopulation programs throughout the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and things like the Human Sterilization Society for Human Betterment became Engender Health, that again is tied very closely to AstraZeneca, Oxford, Gavi. A lot of the big organizations, including the Wellcome Trust, has its roots tied to the original Eugenics Records Office that changed its names, but continued essentially doing the same type of work, but with a different garb to make the unthinkable become thinkable. I would additionally add as a parting thought that just as the fight for win-win versus unipolar animated the past ages, again today, there is a similar schism with the buildup of a military encirclement around China, around Russia's perimeter, with an oncoming economic collapse, which we're sitting again on a bubble economy that could be strategically pricked at any moment. And there's a fight over what the terms of the new system will look like. Will it be a multipolar system where sovereign nation states play a driving role, or will it be this stakeholder capitalism crap of a great reset and eugenics, new eugenics, that the World Economic Forum crowd wants? So I think that that's also useful to keep in mind. It's not like a lost cause. It's not like everybody is in on it. It's that you have this parasite. It's like latched onto the host, but it's afraid of, it has weaknesses. It has fears. It has a lot of insecurities. And I think, again, if you really look despite the problems that you might find within the Eurasian community, there are overall an agenda to not have depopulation, to encourage large-scale projects for the future that encourage growth, empower sovereign nation states to have full-spectrum economies. We don't have that in the West under the World Bank, IMF, BIS, Bank of International Settlement System, which is dominant here. We don't have that spirit in any way. It's antagonistic to it. So it's two incompatible paradigms clashing. And that's important to just hold that in mind, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Matthew sagt, erläutert nochmal, wir müssen genau sehen, was Oligarchie eigentlich bedeutet. Ich hatte ja eben zum Schluss gesagt, das ist diese Gruppe aus globalen Konzernen und globalen NGOs, die offensichtlich von denselben Leuten kontrolliert werden, die wiederum Hintermänner haben, die wiederum auch Hintermänner haben. Er sagt, ja, es gab ja diese Idee dagegen auch, nämlich den von Franklin Roosevelt, die Sovereign Nations, dass das selbstständige, souveräne Nationen miteinander in großen Projekten kooperieren. Also im Grunde das, was wir auch überlegen, dass wir regional uns aufstellen, uns völlig abkoppeln von denen, die uns hier gerade ausplündern und umbringen wollen und unser eigenes Spiel spielen. Aber natürlich müssen wir, das ist jetzt nicht von ihm, sondern von mir, dafür sorgen, dass die Verantwortlichen zur Verantwortung gezogen werden. Vor irgendeinem Gericht wird das passieren. Die Idee dieses Flattening the Curve und auch jetzt Flattening das Bevölkerungswachstum, das beruht, sagt er ja, auf völlig selektiven, also auch wenn man sich die Erderwärmung anguckt, auf völlig selektiven Datensets, die keinerlei Bezug zur Realität haben. Darauf beruhen diese ganzen Depopulationsideen, weil die Natur ja geschützt werden muss, seit den 80ern, 70ern, 80ern und 90ern, die auch von Leuten wie Oxford und also der Oxford University und Gavi und so weiter, natürlich Bill Gates, gepusht werden. Wir sehen jetzt auch, dass ist ja unübersehbar, dass es ein Military Build-up gibt in China, da im südchinesischen Meer droht ein Krieg, in der Ukraine droht ein Krieg, zumindest versucht man uns das glauben zu machen. Ich glaube ja, dass das ganz überwiegend Illusionen sind. Und es droht, das ist keine Illusion, ein wirtschaftlicher Kollaps, aber nur, wenn wir es zulassen. Wenn wir dafür sorgen, dass das, was man uns geklaut hat, zurückkommt, dann droht kein wirtschaftlicher Kollaps. Also es liegt alles in unserer Hand, nach meiner Meinung. Und das sagt er auch, es ist kein Lost Cause. Wir haben hier noch alle Möglichkeiten, denn das, nur wir müssen es eben in die Hand nehmen, denn das, was die andere Seite spielt, hat sehr, sehr viele Weaknesses, Schwächen. Es gibt eine Menge Unsicherheiten dabei. Wir haben die Möglichkeit, wieder zu einem vollen, sicheren System auch wirtschaftlichen Wachstums zu kommen. Aber das darf eben nicht so zerstörerisch sein, wie es bisher gewesen ist. I think I got it. I think we all got it. This was really important, Matthew. This is very interesting in a very short period of time of 50 minutes, I think. This was a race through history, which I think was enlightening to many of us. Many of the things that you told us about, I had it in the back of my head, but you put the dots together, and now it all makes real, real sense. We know what we have to do. We have to stop these bastards.
I have a question. Are you aware of the Wildlands project?
No. What is that?
I read about it, and I think it's like we should look closer into this. But I think, Rosa Corey, I think she looked at that like a while ago. Unfortunately, she's dead now. But I think it's like an idea that, basically they would like to give a lot of nature back to a lot of land back to nature, so that in the US, for instance, you'd have several, just like five areas or something, where people would reside, like in major mega cities, and the rest is like to some extent left to nature, so the buffalo can roam free again. And it's a little bit of a crazy idea, but I don't know if you have a chance to look at that. I researched this at some point, but I think I'm not quite sure what the status is now. But it's an interesting concept, which would also give a little bit more food to the thought that it's maybe for at least this project better if there's not so many folks around.
No, absolutely. And indeed, there has been an ongoing, many think tanks throughout the 1970s and 80s and 90s have talked openly about the idea of turning the United States into eco-regions. So basically, it's a divide-to-conquer strategy, right? To do what was not successful in the Civil War, actually just have the U.S. do it to itself under a new ethic. Of what you just said, define each ecosystem as a self-contained closed system, which it's no ecosystem is a closed system. But they want you to do that because that's how computers work. It's a mathematical function. It's closed. It's not open. And with that presumption, there's an assumption that there's this natural state of equilibrium that all nature is calibrating towards that we have to maintain. The problem is with human beings, because we have 8 billion of our species and we're a creature of thought, our resource is in the mind, which is not material. We discover laws of nature, translate those into new technological innovations. And when we build a dam, we naturally upset the supposed equilibrium of nature. Is that a bad thing? Well, I mean, obviously, there's going to be negative consequences to any change, but do the positives outweigh the negatives? I believe so. But that's the problem with progress. In the mind of an imperialist, progress is troublesome because as soon as you start it, you cannot stop it. And they want stability and control. They're control freaks. So that's why they look for excuses to get us to believe that it's best to cut off creative thought in order to just adapt to controlled environments like a little like the little Darwinian animals they expect us to be, or talking cows on a feudal plantation that adapts to the environments of the plantation lord. And so this has been a technique, a sleight of hand that. And Biden has recently announced, 30% of U.S. farms will be U.S. land will be kept out of development legally in the coming years. That was a law that's been put forth as an executive order by Biden. So they are going forward on this idea. And additionally, when you look at a lot of the protective lands in Africa under conservation organizations sponsored by Prince Philip, Bernhard and others, these are lands which actually provide a hosting service to a variety of terror groups like Boko Haram and other terrorist groups that are useful at keeping nations destabilized and fighting each other, which you don't want them to develop. Because if they develop, says Henry Kissinger in his NSSM 200, then they might start utilizing the resources in Africa under their soil, which those are ours. That's in our strategic interest to control those resources in Nigeria or elsewhere. So these you can look at these maps of these conservation parks all over Africa or South America, and just look at how else they're being used. And they're always overlapping borders of nations. They're never just in a nation. They have geopolitical purposes. So it has a multi-level aspect to it. There's not just one reason. There's several reasons being dealt with at the same time. And there's more to say, but I just ranted. I'm sorry.
No, but I think it's really interesting, also like what they're doing, like what the EU is doing with, the use of the land here as well. Like when you look for, you see that a lot of the regulations are kind of counterproductive. Like, if you say, okay, we want biodiversity, and we want to, this is one of our major goals. And then you have regulation, for instance, I breed a very rare kind of sheep. That's on the verge of extinction. And so it's very strange that there's regulations that you cannot export these rare breeds, the old breeds, within the EU, like even for reproduction purposes, So that leaves like little islands, pockets, within like European countries where basically you have, small crowds of flocks of sheep that are basically, have like maybe like some kind of incestuous problem because they just, it's not diverse enough, the gene pool. And so that's very counterproductive, and that's very strange, for instance. And it's like the pretext was that, they might be genetically more prone to scrapie, the genetic type of scrapie. But then we talked to the sheep, someone who was in charge of sheep for the Bavarian government. And so we asked him, so what's the prevalence of this scrapie, the genetic type of scrapie? And it was in that specific year, I think it was like 2014, it was like 4 dead animals. And then we asked, so what's the non-genetic, scrapie type that kills animals? And it was like the sheep, and it was like 4,000. I mean, what's the point? Why would you then exclude these older types of sheep, which have a certain type of genetic constellation? doesn't make any sense. So it's clearly like a pretext for some maybe industrial purpose or whatever. And like another thing is when you look at the, you know, the reintroduction of the wolf, you know, like which is now, you know, just roaming around free and you cannot shoot the wolf. And I don't want to judge this like on a, you know, because I think wolves are, you know, interesting animals, you know, and maybe it makes sense, maybe it doesn't, but it's kind of very unfortunate to have, like, if you want to go for, like, you know, natural breeding, like, or like roaming of animals, like on the lands, and you don't want to keep them in like a closed house or something, you know, like a barn all the time, but you want to sort of help them live the way they would like to, or like when it's more pleasant out on the fields. So it's basically becomes at some point, it might become impossible to have these animals roam outside, yeah, because they, you know, you always risk that they're going to be caught by a wolf, and a wolf can jump, you know, 5 meter high or 4 meter high fences. I mean, are they all going to be like in a prison, or do we have to, you know, do we have to have our lands in a sort of like prison kind of type when you want to have sheep outside on the field? You know, yeah, it's very strange. No, it's counterproductive. Also.
Yeah, yeah. It's they live in a computer fantasy model. They think that the world responds the way a computer model does, and a computer is reversible, and all sorts of things can apply in a computer binary 1-0 world. But in the real world, it doesn't behave the way that they want it to. And there's so many contradictions to the imperial system. These eugenicists and people who think the way you just outlined. I mean, look at the queen and her husband, her late husband. They're cousins, you know. They're from the same genetic stock. They try to intermarry, which does you no favors. In just look at Prince Charles. I mean, look at what they've done to him. And I would just say one thing: if people want to just write down this book, "How Green Were the Nazis," which goes through the Hermann Göring was the forestry and conservation minister of Germany in the 1930s. And this book outlines, it's a bit expensive nowadays online. They've made it very difficult to purchase, but you can access it. And it's a recent book, but it goes through just the nature conservation agenda of the Nazi Party in terms of trying to create a pure, return Germany to a pure state of the ecosystem it had when it was somehow pure in the hundreds of years earlier, and extracting all of the foreign plants and things that had contaminated Germany. And there was a big project to do this. Yeah, it's a useful read, I would say, and yeah, people would be disturbed to see the transplant of these same thoughts in our current world today.
Okay, ich fasse es noch einmal zusammen. Wir müssen dann zu Ilana rüberschalten, die wartet schon. Er hat jetzt mehrfach betont, dass diese Leute auf der anderen Seite denken wie ein Computer. Wir werden mal drüber nachdenken müssen, wie das kommt. Das ist ein Computer-Fantasiemodell, in dem die sich bewegen. Die wollen volle Kontrolle. Da steht auch die durch kreative Menschen entwickelte Fortschritt im Wege. Und deswegen tun die alles, um sowas zu verhindern. Alles hat auch einen zweiten Zweck. Auch das, was auf den ersten Blick ganz toll aussieht, wie zum Beispiel die, wie heißt das, nicht Reservate, sondern die Naturschutzgebiete, insbesondere in Afrika, die nicht aus Versehen, meistens über mehrere Staaten, also nicht in einem Staat alleine liegen, sondern über mehrere Staatsgrenzen hinweglaufen. Die sind gleichzeitig auch die Rückzugsgebiete für terroristische Gruppen wie Boko Haram. Ich glaube, das war's in etwa. Ne? Oder willst du noch deine Schlafschafe nochmal?
Die Schlafschafe, ja, die schlafen nicht ganz so wie vielleicht andere Leute. Nein, aber jedenfalls die ich hatte noch zwei, drei Sachen gesagt. Und zwar einmal, dass es gibt so ein ein Wildlands Project, was in Amerika, ich hatte das schon mal untersuchen, müsste gucken, wie da jetzt der Status ist im Moment. Da sind Ideen, dass man eben große Ländereien in Amerika zusammenfügt, sodass es so ein durchlaufendes Naturschutzgebiet gibt, wo quasi der Büffel wieder seinen natürlichen Wanderweg hat. Aber das bedeutet natürlich auch, dass die Menschen dort weichen müssen. Also das ist natürlich ein ganz interessantes Konzept, auch vielleicht in der aktuellen Konstellation müsste man sich nochmal genauer anschauen. Und auch diese Agenda 2030, die verhindert ja auch sehr stark die Nutzung von Ländereien und Konstellationen durch Menschen. Und das oder schränkt es jedenfalls sehr stark ein. Und ich hatte noch erwähnt, dass es eben sehr, sagen wir mal, erklärten Zielen gegenüber, zum Beispiel Beispiel der Biodiversität, was ja die EU sich stark auf die Fahnen geschrieben hat, gibt es eben Regularien, die völlig kontraproduktiv sind. Zum Beispiel, also ich züchte ja eine sehr stark vom Aussterben bedrohte Schafrasse, wo es überhaupt nur 300 Tiere circa gibt. Und da ist es so, dass es eben ein Verbot gibt, solche alten Rassen zu exportieren innerhalb der EU, und zwar insbesondere zu Zuchtzwecken. Also das Fleisch dürfte man exportieren, also wir schlachten die Tiere nicht, aber jedenfalls das dürfte man exportieren, aber eben nicht zu Zuchtzwecken. Und dadurch hat man natürlich in der EU kleine Taschen sozusagen oder kleine Inseln, wo solche Tiere gehalten werden, und man kann eben gerade den für den Genpool erforderlichen Austausch nicht durchführen. Fragt sich, warum das so ist, wenn ich auf Biodiversität Wert lege, und da mag es eben irgendwelche Strukturen geben, die vielleicht dann auch so, weiß ich nicht, Industrieschafe verkaufen wollen, oder die vielleicht auch darauf hoffen, dass da irgendwann dieses
das kann nur dahinter stehen.
Allel ausstirbt und man es sich dann patentieren lassen kann, was auch immer. Also jedenfalls solche Konstellationen, auch mit dem Wolf, hatte ich noch erwähnt, ist auch ein gewisses Problem, weil, also ich möchte den Wolf jetzt nicht irgendwie, ist ja auch ein romantisches Tier oder wie auch eben romantisch besetzt, nur ist natürlich auch ein gefährliches Tier, und wir sehen eben, dass auch in bestimmten Regionen es schwieriger wird, Tiere eben draußen zu haben, weil natürlich immer die Gefahr besteht, dass sie auch vom Wolf erwischt werden. Und man kann sich da trotz der ganzen Zuschüsse und was da immer gesagt wird, gar nicht schützen vor der Gefahr, weil Wölfe auch über 4 Meter hohe Zäune springen können. Und man möchte ja auch nicht unbedingt, dass ein Acker dann wie in eine Justizvollzugsanstalt ausschaut, mit also eingezäunt in dieser Form, was sowieso zusätzlich nichts bringt und auch natürlich finanziell gar nicht darstellbar ist. Also viele kontraproduktive Dinge, die ineinander greifen, wo man eben auch sich immer fragt, was ist da eigentlich das dahinterliegende Interesse, oder ist es einfach nur Dilettantismus, aber es wirkt doch ein bisschen so, als sei etwas anderes.
Yeah. Tja. Well, thank you, Matthew. I know a lot of people keep telling me, don't tell everyone that we're going to be in touch and we're going to talk again. And I don't. But in your case, again, we need some more time. So we'll be in touch and we'll talk again.
Great. I look forward to it.
Thank you, Matthew. Have a great weekend. We're not quite that far yet. It's only Thursday, but still.
I appreciate the sentiment. Yeah, I believe in the future.
Okay, thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.